This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with James O'Mara. Hey, James.
Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Good. So you have a new book out. It's called The Eldritch, Evola, and Other Traditional Meditations on Literature, Art, and Culture. Tell us about this book and how it relates to your previous book that came out a while back.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting sort of collection of essays. The title essay. Well, perhaps I should just say that there's a series of essays, three or four of them, right at the beginning, that share a sort of common theme, which is an attempt to read traditionalist themes in what's thought of as establishment American literature, the great works, Melville, Henry James in particular, leading up to Lovecraft, who is sort of an equivocal figure in American literature, but has recently come to be kind of canonic. He's in the Library of America there with James and Melville, so I treat him as an equivalent. And it's an attempt, as I say, to read traditionalist themes in that literature, work from Guénon and Evola and so on. And so that interconnected series of four or five essays dealing with some works of Henry James, in particular his American Notes, which is a very very new right sort of work, particularly as he comes back from Europe and deals with what New York has become. And it's interesting to read him on how New York has degenerated in his view.
And what era in history are you talking about, from when to when?
Yeah, so as I say, I'm dealing with things from Melville through Lovecraft. So that's about almost 100 years, from about 1840 to the 1930s. James is returning to New York around 1905, so we're seeing his reaction, having lived in Europe. He's coming back to New York and America in particular. But I focus on New York because that's how I link him to Lovecraft, because his reaction to New York in 1905 is very similar to Lovecraft's reaction to New York in, I'm not sure exactly when he was there at the moment, like 1925 or thereabouts.
I wonder what their reaction would be to New York today.
What's that?
I wonder what their reaction would be to New York today.
they would be pretty horrified by it, actually. In fact, what's interesting about it is that people are more or less familiar with the idea that Lovecraft had a kind of extreme reaction to New York when he moved to New York, actually to Brooklyn, in the 1920s when he married. And that's sort of like treated as kind of an odd, interesting little part of his life. But if you read what he says about New York, it's very very much what someone, particularly someone of a traditionalist mind, would feel about New York today. So it's kind of like he's in a typical Lovecraft fashion, sort of anticipating in his own life, in his own experiences, what New York is really like today in the future, what would be his future. And there's a story he wrote, which I focus on, called He, the pronoun he, in which Lovecraft is wandering around in Greenwich Village and sort of time travels in this odd sort of way. He meets a typical Lovecraftian evil old man who shows him a window that he looks out on, and he sees the future of New York. And the future of New York looks exactly like New York today, the gigantic buildings and the vaguely oriental people streaming about in the streets and so on. And what's particularly interesting is that that might be dismissed as a kind of pulp writer's horror fiction neurosis and so on. But if you read what Henry James wrote about New York in 1905, it's almost exactly the same. So it's as I say, it's interesting to see James and Lovecraft and New York today, the sort of continuity of the the increasing degeneration in horror that the streets present to us. Although I also deal with of course, other themes that present themselves in those works, in an essay called The Corner at the Center of the World. I deal with James, a very late story of James's that also takes place in New York called The Jolly Corner, and I relate it to Guénon's metaphysics, particularly in his book The Symbolism of the Cross. So it's throughout those essays, there's an attempt, as I say, to bring together standard American literature and the metaphysics of the traditionalist sort. What's interesting, I think, about this book is that it has these essays, which were my first writings for Countercurrents. And I had originally thought that they would make.
And
it's
nice just published by Countercurrents.
And it's published by Countercurrents. I should say that in terms of technical matters, it's published by Countercurrents. It's currently available. It has been available for a month now as a Kindle on Amazon for $5.99. And I talked to Greg Johnson, the publisher, today, as a matter of fact, quite coincidentally, and it will be in print, in paperback, and in hardcover probably about by the end of next week. So if people prefer to get the print version, they can now get that. They're essentially the same. The print version has an index, but otherwise they're identical. And it has those essays, which I had originally conceived as my first book. It's kind of like a small chapbook sort of thing, about 40 pages or so. Which, of course, Greg had a different idea about what my first book should be, and that appeared a couple of years ago as The Homo and the Negro.
So this is your second book.
And this is the second book. So in an odd sort of way, it goes back to my first writings. So it actually reflects earlier stages of my thought than the first book. But it also includes more recent writings. So it's kind of a time and space continuum strangeness kind of deal. So it also has very very recent writings that I've been putting out on Countercurrents.
So you talk about traditionalism, and I guess you describe yourself as a traditionalist. But I remember on a previous interview we did, I think it was about the Homo and the Negro book, you talk about this idea of Gonzo traditionalism, because I think a lot of people, when they hear the word traditionalism, they have this image of being very someone who's very kind of boring or square, and you're making the case that doesn't have to be the case.
I think that's correct. I think the ideas that the traditionalists are pushing are by their nature timeless ideas, and they don't really belong to any one period, any one era. So there shouldn't be anything particularly antiquarian about them. I think the idea that that tradition is something that's old and needs to be dug up is a misunderstanding. I mean, that can't be tradition, because tradition has to be something that's outside of time.
And the problem,
always relevant.
The problem with the idea of traditionalism sometimes is what era. Like, people have a certain era. Some people, it's the 1950s. Some people, it could be the Old West. Some people, it could be like the Puritans, or it could be the European Renaissance, the Greeks, the Romans. I mean, how do you sort of summarize traditionalism?
Sure.
Is it about copying an era, or?
Well, that's a very important point you make. That's exactly something that I've been trying to emphasize. A lot of people just use the word traditionalism and to basically mean sort of harking back to the past, to a particular era. And generally speaking, it seems to be the era when they were children or when they were young adults. It's the good old days, essentially.
So that sort of means, like, 30 years ago, a traditionalist will be someone wanting to emulate today.
Well, I would say it the other way around. I mean, that there are people today who would call themselves traditionalists, and if you ask them what they mean by that, then they basically mean the way it was when I was a child. Let me put it this way: many years ago, I was living in Colorado, and I had a friend who was a Mormon, a sort of ex-Mormon. He was very, very interested in, National Review, William Buckley, and so on. And he pointed out, I don't know how this came up exactly, but he pointed out his favorite band, his favorite music. If I say his favorite band, that already sort of gives it away, because obviously he's not talking about Beethoven or something. His favorite band was Led Zeppelin. And he pointed out that, it might seem strange that a Mormon would like Led Zeppelin, but he said people like the music that they grew up with. And, whether you're a Mormon or a traditionalist Catholic or a Hindu, if you grew up with Led Zeppelin, that's going to be your favorite music. And that's the sense in which people are. I like to use the word conservative for people like that. I mean, that's the people who basically think that things went wrong at some point in their adulthood and we should just go back.
So I think it's important to make a distinction that conservatives are not the same as traditionalists.
Well, yeah, as I'm using the terms, because I think it marks a helpful distinction. As I said before, traditionalism should be something that's timeless. It's not about going back to the old days. It's about getting back to the original principles. Someone like Ezra Pound, for instance, obviously a modernist, he used the expression, make it new. So the traditionalist is not someone who wants to go back to the old days and do the same thing people did before. A traditionalist is someone who understands and acknowledges timeless principles, which he recognizes in the past, of course, and wants to initiate in the present. So he may not, for instance, be at all interested in, say, classical music, but he will be interested in the kind of music that seems to instantiate those traditionalist principles. This gets to something I devote some space to in the book, and this is an example of some of my most recent writing, about Wagner. There's a certain sort of conservative, certainly, and there's certainly a kind of traditionalist who thinks that Wagner is what we should be listening to, that Wagner is the model for how we should go forward. And it's interesting that if you actually read the traditionalist writers like Gainon and Evola and so on, and Alain Danielou, they disliked Wagner. In fact, I made a little list for myself of traditionalists, Anthony Ludovici, for instance, Nietzsche, of course, who detested Wagner, which is not to say that they don't recognize his greatness of a kind, but it's not the model for what's going forward. So a conservative, for instance, is someone who thinks, we should go back to the days of Wagner. Big orchestras, opera houses, Parsifal. That was the way things should be. A traditionalist, by my mind, is someone who wants to go back to the basic principles of metaphysics, the principles of music, and so on. And he may be more excited by something like, say, the master musicians of Jijuka, rather than Wagner. You may look at Wagner and see degeneracy. Wagner is not the timeless ideal. Wagner is degenerate, perhaps, from his point of view. Certainly Nietzsche came to think of Wagner as degenerate. Kumaraswamy and Daniel Liu and the other traditionalists who were interested in music thought Wagner was a degenerate. Evola wanted to burn the opera houses. He was glad to see the end of this sort of bourgeois music and welcomed new developments. He understood the appeal of jazz, for instance, just as my friend in Colorado understood the appeal of Led Zeppelin. He understood the appeal of jazz because there was a lot that was lacking in classical music. And so if you look at the historical development of things, being in history, they, of course, are inferior to the principles. So you can always refer back to the principles for purposes of criticism and say, well, we see where Wagner goes wrong. We can do better. And see, that's why I think it's foolish to think as a conservative does and think that we can just go back to the old days. The old days had their problems, and that's why we're in the mess we're in today. If you go back to the old days, Marx said something very profound. He criticized the idea of this primitive socialism, as he called it, where the idea was just to redistribute income. He said if you just redistribute income, the same shit, he used that word, the same shit will start all over again. In other words, you have to go back to the principles and set things straight. If you go back to Wagner, you're just going to go right back to Miley Cyrus. It's just going to start all over again, because there's a reason why you go from Wagner to Miley Cyrus. So in a series of essays that are in that book, I critique Wagner from a traditionalist point of view, but recognizing his greatness, and I say he's great in those essays, but recognizing his deficiencies and suggesting that instead of wanting to go back to Wagner, as conservatives do, we should go above Wagner to the principles of traditionalist music and try to create our own music in the contemporary era in alignment with those traditionalist principles. That's traditionalism, not emulating some random historical example like Wagner or Beethoven, but going back to the principles and, as Ezra Pound said, making it new. So I promote the work there of Harry Partch, a sort of vagabond hobo of American composers, who all by himself seems to have rediscovered many traditionalist principles, which he instantiated in his music. And it seems to me more profitable for traditionalists to champion such men rather than the standard old bourgeois establishment types like Wagner, who are dead anyway. And, put our emphasis on doing something new, rather than presenting traditionalism as, a sort of a establishment conservational sort of thing. Let's preserve the opera houses, let's preserve Wagner and listen to that forever. Let's make traditionalism a matter of innovation. Let's be the real avant-garde.
So it's progressive traditionalism. You don't mean going back in time, but creating something new with the inspiration of the best of the past. Is that what you're getting at?
I would only quibble with the idea of the best of the past. It's a question of not so much the best of the past, but of transcending that history, transcending time, and going back to the principles that the best of the past is the best because they were using those ideas. I mean, we, as Ezra Pound says, make it new. Harry Partch, for instance, in the essays, I quote various things where he talks about having an original relationship to tradition, that the idea is not to imitate what other people have done that's traditional. It may be traditional. There's no arguing that. Hey, this is traditional. That's what the people did in accordance with tradition. But what we should do is not imitate them, but access those same timeless principles and redo it ourselves in the modern age. So the traditionalist is in many ways, and has been at various points, the real avant-garde.
Can you be very specific about what those fundamental principles are?
Well, I think that, for instance, in the case of music, I think that there's a traditional theory of music, a traditional doctrine of music, that, and I explain this in the book, of course, in greater detail. But there is a traditional doctrine of what music is and what it can be and what it can do. You can find that in the works of Alain Denis, who's sort of like the lost traditionalist. He's one of the four major traditionalist writers, but he's one that's very seldom spoken of. And despite the fact that Guénon himself was in contact with him as someone who was actually living in India as a tradition in a traditional lifestyle, basically the idea is that just as everything else in a traditional society is interconnected, so music has its part in a traditional society. You can't simply say Wagner is great, therefore we should have opera houses, therefore in our future traditional society there will be an opera house inserted here and it will play Siegfried over and over again. Music has to be a part of culture. Traditional cultures are integral cultures because every aspect of the culture is based on traditional principles.
And it has to be something that's alive and constantly growing. You can't have something. You can't just have like everything put in a museum and just like frozen in time.
Exactly. As Kumar Swami, you know, was always pointing out, and of course he was the Indian curator for the Boston Museum of Art. You know, the things that we put in museums as artifacts and pieces of art are everyday objects in traditional society. But to get to this point, I mean, someone like, I think a traditionalist should be someone not who's trying to preserve Wagner for any particular reason. I don't mean to harp on Wagner, but you know as well as I do, you know, Wagner is kind of a sacred icon.
I'll be honest. I think that there's a lot of people in the sort of quoting, I don't know if I should use the word new right, but they're obsessed with Wagner just because of the whole sort of the controversy around him, if you catch my drift. That they're kind of obsessed with him for those reasons. Would you say that's true?
I think that's true. I think I understand that, and I honored that. I honor that. You know, I mean, I get where they're coming from. You know, I understand that. What we need to do is to, you know, not imitate the past, but access the timeless principles that will enable us to do something new today. What I was saying was that someone, a real traditionalist, is not someone who is just going to like preserve Wagner. I mean, we have museums to do that, and so on. And there's nothing wrong with that, but a real traditionalist should be using the traditional doctrines that apply to music, because indeed there are traditional doctrines that apply to everything, and creating new music. And I think that, in other words, a real traditionalist is going to be someone more like Harry Parch or Moondog, if I may allude to someone that's occasionally see referred to on the right. Is going to be someone like that who is doing something new. So the traditionalist may be more avant-garde, actually, than either a conservative who's just trying to preserve Wagner, or, say, a politically correct liberal leftist type who, you know, who is not so much looking to tradition as he's looking to ideology and contemporary shibboleths and so on, and, you know, we'll try to create an opera that's, you know, has ethnic diversity and you know, has a balance of male and female roles, or, you know, whatever. You know, there are all these extraneous things that have nothing to do with tradition. And if you look at real tradition, and works that are really influenced by tradition, many of them are far more avant-garde than the sort of thing you would see consider as a something that a conservative would be promoting. So that's one aspect of the book. There's a series of essays, and they appeared on Countercurrents, and there was some controversy generated for the reasons that you just articulated, that Wagner is something of a sacred icon. Amplifying myself, I thought it was a sort of Nietzschean thing for me to do, to sort of challenge that Wagner icon. I mean, Nietzsche did it, and yet Wagner still remains. You know, it's very interesting if you read Ludovici's introduction to the Case of Wagner, his translation from 1910 or thereabouts. And Ludovici is a figure that shows up on the right. If you look at his introduction, it's very interesting. He talks about how the Wagner cult has died in Europe, and it survives only here in England because England is so backward in its culture. But eventually, it will all die out here as well, which is very interesting. Now, this is a figure of the right, who's somewhat popular on the new right today, and he's very, straightforward about the fact that Wagner is the wrong way to go, and only the bourgeois dying elements of our culture are trying to preserve him. But fortunately, in Europe, they've already learned better and agree with Nietzsche and so on. And here we are 100 years later, and people are just, dumbfounded that I would dare question the greatness of Wagner.
That's a good point. I heard someone said, I think it was Daryl Bazarab who said this, but he says basically that the far right is basically the old bourgeois that got displaced by the new bourgeois.
I had not heard that before. That's interesting. That may very well be what I'm talking about. Yeah, because if you think of the old bourgeois as being the opera lovers, the traditional opera lovers, and the new bourgeois, of course, would be the politically correct leftist sort of types who, in some strange way, have become the ruling class but deny that they're the ruling class and continue to have the self-image that they promote of being, edgy and challenging and so on, even though they're the ones in power. You know, this is the essence of the political correct culture that we live in. That we're ruled by these bureaucrats and academics and NPR listeners and so on, who all think of themselves as sticking it to the man constantly. They're constantly sticking it to the man. You know, the people on the left are constantly sticking it to the man, even though they are the man today. And I suppose the people on the right, conventionally speaking, I guess, or in this picture I'm giving, are the people who sort of represent the old bourgeois. And they think of themselves as sticking it to the man because they're not politically correct or something like that. But it's in the name of this old bourgeoisie. And I align myself with Evola and Ludovici and so on of saying, it's good that the old bourgeoisie has fallen apart. I mean, that's what's good about the left and the avant-garde and so on. But rather than creating a new bourgeoisie or trying to revive the old bourgeoisie, let's go back to principles. Let's rebuild our culture. Let's rebuild our society on the basis of some metaphysically solid principles, rather than going down the road of politically correct leftism and all that, or trying to recreate the old bourgeois world. The old bourgeois world died for a reason. Modulate here to politics. Hitler failed for a reason. There's no point in emulating Hitler in the sense of, let's all be just like National Socialists.
And even Evola, Evola, the thing about him is he's been described as a quote-unquote fascist, but he wasn't necessarily, like, saying that the fascist system was the ideal system. He just sort of supported it because he saw fascists as having the right, as the same enemies that he did, but he wasn't just necessarily, I don't think it's a good way to describe him as a fascist himself. He definitely had criticisms of fascism.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, without, again, without trying to puff myself up or anything like that, I might say I might think of my position as being somewhat like Evola's position regarding fascism when he said that I'm not a fascist, I'm a super fascist. And that is to say, you know, like supernatural or metaphysics or something like that, you know, above fascism. And he explained it as saying that when fascism, you know, is promoting what needs to be promoted, then I support it. When they deviate from that, I reserve the right to criticize it.
How many of the themes from The Homo and the Negro do you continue into this book?
I would say that in this book, it's a different kind of book because it's more, as you can see, it's more oriented towards a kind of more typical culture sort of thing. It deals with books and music. And so there's less opportunity for a kind of polemical sort of thing, but the same basic viewpoint is there. As I said at the beginning, the essays at the beginning were actually the first things I wrote for Countercurrents, and the essays towards the end are the most recent things I've written for Countercurrents. So Homo and the Negro itself is kind of like occupies a kind of middle position. So you won't find really any, shall we say, development in the thought because there's no chronological development in it. I think it refines a number of ideas. It's probably a more refined work to that extent. I think it's all consistent.
The title, it's a different, it's more, the title's more sort of an academic sounding. Homo and the Negro, the title really is not, it's less academic, it's more sort of in your face.
Well, that's exactly right. The Homo and the Negro actually, well, you know, with this subtlety, the Homo and the Negro actually is the first thing I wrote in my modern, you know, what I am today sort of being. So actually that is the earliest thing. So it's somewhat misleading, but it never appeared on Countercurrents. So the first things I wrote on Countercurrents are in The Eldritch Evola. Homo and the Negro was the first thing I wrote, and it was designed to be a manifesto. I had, the surrealists and the futurists in mind, and more recently, Hakim Bey and his temporary autonomous zone writings and so on. I wanted it to be like that. I wanted it to be, you know, hard-hitting. It was sort of supposed to be Nietzschean, you know, testing idols by hitting them with a hammer sort of thing. It was an in-your-face sort of thing, and that's why it was given that title, and Greg thought that would be a good title for the whole collection. I don't know if the Eldritch Evola is really a more academic sort of title. It's more sedate. I think Eldritch is the sort of word that Lovecraft fanatics would sort of nod their heads at.
And what would you, how would you describe sort of Lovecraft to, let's say, your average person who's never heard of him?
I would say that, rather than describing Lovecraft, I would say, why should you read Lovecraft? Why should you read Lovecraft?
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
You know, why should you be interested in this guy? It's because he has a very interesting take on modernity. he is trying to understand modernity. He's a very traditionalist, or indeed even a conservative sort of guy, and he has the ability to see further into modernity than most people. And what he sees horrifies him. And he's able to convey that horror. So, the reason why he's probably, undoubtedly more popular today than he was in his own time, for instance, is because in his own time, people, if they did read his work, of course it wasn't published very widely, but if they did read his work, they thought, oh, this is some guy trying to scare us, you know, by making up stuff. And but if you read him today, you can sense that he's actually he's scared because he's seeing the world that's coming, and that's the world that we're living in now. So it gives us a very interesting take on the modern world. He's looking at things that we take for granted today, and reminding us that they're not that great. That there's something really terrifying about the way that we live, and I think that's what makes him interesting to the modern world, and I think that's why he seems so relevant to the modern world. It's difficult to think of anyone writing in the 1920s and 1930s that people think of today as being absolutely relevant. You know, I mean, there are many, mostly lousy movies, but nevertheless, a lot of movies that are adapted from Lovecraft, and television shows often make use of his motifs.
Can you give examples of some of those movies?
There's an excellent movie actually made by these people. I'm sorry, I'm not, completely up to date on them and all that. I can't do them justice. But there's an organization called like the Lovecraft Antiquarian Society or something like that that actually have made movies based on Lovecraft's works. They made an excellent movie a few years back called based on the Whisperer in Darkness, which kind of like semi-update Lovecraft stuff. I mean, they put it in the right period. It's in the same period, but it's done in the style of, and it's done in like a black and white 1930s serial type style, but it's with sort of like the Indiana Jones kind of mentality behind it. So it's a very contemporary looking film. In other words, they're not trying to make it look like Nosferatu or something like that. But it's very, very faithful in a way, what was the one they did before them? Sorry, I can't think of the one they did before them. But you can go to Amazon, look for a movie called The Shadow, The Whisperer in Darkness, and you'll find it and find the other ones. But there's actually all kinds of lousy Euro films that have been made, and even Hollywood made a couple of films, Dunwich Horror, and in England they made The Shuttered Room. But even more than that, I mean, there's like the whole Lovecraft sort of mentality that you find in, the X-Files and so on. And there's a series that was on Showtime or HBO that was based around the works of, what's his name, Robert Chambers, who, of course, is not H.P. Lovecraft, but he was one of the, Lovecraft thought was one of the great writers. That is to say, his book, The King in Yellow, Lovecraft thought was one of the great works, and Chambers eventually, just all his later stuff is just crap, it's just bestseller crap. But The King in Yellow, Lovecraft thought was a giant of the horror genre, and that was apparently a series on Showtime recently, which I know only because there's like thousands, literally dozens at least, of repackagings of those public domain editions of The King in Yellow, said, based on, I can't think of the name of the Showtime series.
So
that whole sort of era is terribly relevant, whereas there's nothing else from the, this Chambers character was writing in like the 1900 or thereabouts. I mean, you think of 1900s, like, guys in seersucker suits and straw hats and so on, and there's nothing at all from that period that anybody thinks of as terribly relevant, except for, Lovecraft and people in his tradition, like Bierce and so on. I think it's because they perceived that the future was horrific. There's a phrase I use in The Eldritch Evola, the essay called The Eldritch Evola, which is, what is it that links Lovecraft and Evola, Lovecraft and traditionalism? It's the idea that the worst that can happen has already happened, and there's nothing you can do about it.
And now, yeah, that basically kind of summarizes where we are today.
Actually, of course, for someone like Evola, for a traditionalist, the worst that can happen happened in, thousands of years ago. And, all of human history, recorded human history, is just recording a decline, a decadence.
So...
There's nothing you can do about it. See, that's the aspect of Lovecraft and Evola, and Lovecraft and traditionalism, that it's set in stone. You've touched the stone and the mechanism starts and the door opens and the mummy rises. There's nothing you can do at this point except ride it out in some way. And all this is based on the idea that I had that Gaynon's The Reign of Quantity is the scariest book I've ever read. Forget about Stephen King or even Lovecraft or anybody like that. The scariest book I've ever read is The Reign of Quantity. And that's the message of it, that the worst thing that could possibly happen to you has already happened. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it.